Blog Talk Radio.
Bodies littered the streets between the charred remains of buildings. Even the Spaniards reeled in shock. One soldier emerged from the silence of the aftermath, frozen like a wooden statue, until he died. A mobile fighting man hung himself by his bowstring rather than be left to survive alone. 82 of DeSoto's men died, and every one of his soldiers was wounded, many seriously. For a month, the army was forced to stop and recover. Then, as the surrounding Indian nations watched in horror, DeSoto renewed his march. But his army had been weakened. The tide was beginning to turn. In April of 1541, the invaders reached the Mississippi River. There, DeSoto heard stories of the powerful Natchez Nation, direct inheritors of the grand Mississippian culture. Natchez influence, both economic and military, spread in all directions along the Mississippi. Their temple pyramids rose majestically along the banks of the rivers. The Natchez paramount chief, Quigalton, was heir to the tradition of the Great Sons and spiritual head of a powerful religious aristocracy. His title was Son of the Sun. He was carried on a litter so his feet would never touch the ground. His head was flattened according to Natchez custom, and tattoos of black, red, and blue designs were etched across his body. DeSoto, claiming that he too was a child of the sun, summoned the Natchez leader to the Spanish camp. Quigalton sent back his reply.
With respect to what DeSoto said about being the son of the sun, let him dry up the great river, and I will believe him. With respect to the rest, I am not accustomed to visit anyone. On the contrary, all of whom I have knowledge, visit and serve me and obey me and pay me tribute. Quigalton, Natchez.
DeSoto would never meet Quigalton or see the wealth of the Natchez. On May 21st, 1542, he died. His body was buried in the Mississippi. Over the following year, DeSoto's army ventured as far west as Texas before returning to the Mississippi. There, they built a flotilla and headed downriver for the Gulf of Mexico. En route, they were met by 100 magnificently painted Natchez canoes arrayed in battle formation. Seated under canopies, fighting men, dressed in vivid colors and wearing large headdress plumes, drove the Spanish boats out of Natchez territory and downriver, where one tribe after another picked up the pursuit. The Spaniards reached the Gulf of Mexico on July 18, 1543, setting sail for Spanish outposts on the Mexican coast. For the American Indian nations, DeSoto's expedition mercifully came to an end. But it would not be the end of DeSoto's influence on the continent. 20 years later, another expedition would enter the southeast, this time to colonize. In Spain, the agricultural wealth of the region had become legendary. But the new arrivals found few people and could barely survive. In desperation, they traveled north to the land of the Cusa, where DeSoto's army had passed through 12 thriving towns on a single day's march. But instead of the fabled towns, they found ruins and temple mounds deserted and overgrown. And instead of populations of thousands, they found only pockets of survivors.
Our village had once been very great and populous. But other men similar to you destroyed it and forced us to run away in fear. Nanepakana Kusa.
Unknown to De Soto, the sick man he had left with the Kusa carried a weapon far more deadly than Spanish arms. While the army carved a path of destruction through the southeast, a hidden enemy that would take more Indian lives than all the generals and conquistadors combined was secretly traveling among them.
The Europeans had tremendous immunity and resistance to the diseases that they had known for tens of thousands of years. Smallpox, even the plague, chickenpox, whooping cough, measles, mumps. The Indians had no epidemic diseases. None of these were there. Consequently, they had no immunities, absolutely no resistance. So a disease as simple as mumps that we think of today as a childhood disease, it would come into an Indian community and quite possibly kill off 20% of the village. Then the next year, another disease could come through, such as smallpox, and kill off perhaps 30% of the village. So the Indians were tremendously weakened by disease.
Knowledge was lost as elders died suddenly. Nations were thrown into upheaval. In less than 20 years, civilizations that had flourished for centuries swirled into oblivion.
Most Americans grow up with the story of the Pilgrims landing at Plymouth Rock, and how they were the first to encounter Indian people in an untouched wilderness. But in fact, the arrival of English colonists was by no means the first encounter. By the time the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth, English slavers and traders had been working the region for decades. Two of the first Indian people the Pilgrims met spoke English. One of them had even been to England. It would have been easy for the Indian nations to destroy the original settlements, but they didn't. Instead, they welcomed them as potential trading partners and allies. They gave them land and the knowledge of how to survive on it. But nothing in the experience of the Indian nations had prepared them for the European invasion that would follow. But before we look at the first colonists, we'll go north to a people the English would never conquer, the Inuit, the people who most of us know as Eskimos. Welcome to part four of 500 Nations. Invasion of the coast.
And I think over again my small adventures when, with a shore wind, I drifted out in my kayak and thought I was in danger. My fears, those I thought so big for all the vital things I had to get and to reach. And yet, there was only one great thing, the only thing, to live, to see, in hunts and on journeys, the great day that dawns, and the light that fills the world. Inuit.
In the northern reaches of the continent, straddling the Arctic Circle, lies an island larger than Great Britain, Baffinland. This was the world of the East Baffinland Inuit, people commonly known as Eskimo. For the Inuit, the spring thaw was a time of euphoria and plenty. Small bands would move to summer camps along Baffinland's great southern bay. There they would hunt caribou along the coast, and seal and walruses in the rich marine waters.
Thank you.
The great sea has sent me adrift. It moves me as the weed in a great river. Earth and the great weather move me, have carried me away, and move my inward parts with joy.
Uvavnuk, Inuit.
The summer of 1576 would bring something different. That summer, English sea captain Martin Frobisher led an expedition in search of a northern passage to the Orient. In July, he passed between masses of broken pack ice and through a mountainous channel he named Frobisher Straits. As the English sailed into the bay, several Inuit launched their kayaks and paddled toward the ship. Events were followed by the ship's chronicler.
Our captain discovered a number of small things fleeting in the sea afar off, which he supposed to be porpoises or seals or some kind of strange fish. But coming nearer, he discovered them to be men in small boats made of leather.
The Inuit offered fish, sealskin clothing, and friendship. One man agreed to guide the Europeans through the straits to a place Frobisher believed to be the Pacific Ocean. Five sailors were dispatched in a small skiff to row the Inuit guide to his kayak on shore. Then, for reasons that may never be known, the Englishman disobeyed Frobisher's orders not to row out of sight of the ship.
Contrary to his commandment, they rowed further beyond that point of the land out of his sight. He could not hear nor see anything of them, and thereby he judged they were taken and kept by force.
Although Inuit continued to approach the ship for trade, Frobisher was convinced of treachery. Preparing to weigh anchor, he decided to take a prize back to his patrons in England.
The captain was oppressed with sorrow that he should return again back to his country without bringing any evidence or token of any place whereby to certify to the world where he had been.
Frobisher held out a bell toward an Inuit trader whose kayak had drawn near the ship. Reaching toward the hand outstretched in friendship, Frobisher seized the man, dragging him aboard. He then set sail for England, leaving behind his five missing men. But Frobisher would be denied his living trophy. Aboard ship, the captive Inuit defiantly bit his tongue in half and later died. Soon after Frobisher left Baffinland, the winter ice floes closed the bay and the Inuit returned to their winter lives. The following summer, Frobisher returned to Baffinland. On July 31st, one of his ships put ashore at a point some 150 miles from where his five men had disappeared the previous year. Stumbling upon a vacant Inuit summer camp, they found articles of European clothing.
In these tents, they beheld a doublet of canvas made after the English fashion, a shirt, a girdle, three shoes for contrary feet and of unequal bigness, which they well conjectured to be the apparel of our five poor countrymen.
The next day, Frobisher sent 40 soldiers back to the area, where they surprised 18 Inuit men, women, and children. As the Inuit fled their tents, the English opened fire. Dodging bullets, the Inuit ran for the shore. Launching a large boat called an umiak, they tried to escape to open water, but English boats forced them back against the rocky coast. Frantically, they climbed up the crags above the waves. Soldiers surrounded them from land and sea. While women and children huddled against the rocks, the Inuit men fought for their lives.
And desperately returning upon our men, resisted them manfully so long as their arrows lasted. And after gathering up those arrows which our men shot at them, yea, and plucking our arrows out of their bodies, maintained their cause until both weapons and life utterly failed them. And when they found they were mortally wounded, with deadly fury they cast themselves headlong from off the rocks into the sea, lest perhaps their enemies should receive glory.
Some Inuit scrambled over the rocks, slippery with blood and the wash of the sea, and escaped. A woman and her wounded child were less fortunate. Frobisher took them captive. Along with a man he had captured days before, he had now collected a set of Inuit people. As his ship sailed for England, Frobisher displayed little compassion for the kidnapped victims torn away from their homes and families. They were confined together, the English crew allowed to watch them for entertainment, hoping to see them mate.
Having now got a woman captive for the comfort of our man, we brought them both together, and every man, with silence, desired to behold the manner of their meeting and entertainment.
The crew was to be disappointed by the couple's dignity.
Although they lived continually together, yet did they never use as man and wife, and they both were most shamefast lest any of their private parts be discovered.
Upon arrival in England, artist John White painted these portraits. Soon after, the Inuit man, woman, and child all died of illness. The following spring, Frobisher sailed on his final voyage to the Inuit world. This time, no one came forward to greet the ships. The Inuit held themselves aloof, refusing contact. The English never solved the mystery of their missing men. But for centuries, the Inuit would tell the story of the five white men Frobisher abandoned. It was said that, after living peacefully among them, one spring the five men outfitted an umiak with a mast and sails and departed, never to be seen again. In 1600, the Atlantic coast of North America, the present-day United States, was home to well over 100 Indian nations. Nations nourished by fertile farmlands and bountiful hunting and fishing. Well-maintained gardens produced corn, squash, and a variety of other fruits and vegetables. Summer fishing camps stretched along the barrier islands. Sounds and estuaries swarmed with fish, harvested by traps and nets. Land, people, and teachings had melded into a rich, sophisticated way of life. At the very center of the Atlantic seaboard, south of present-day Washington, D.C., 30 small nations united in the early 1600s to form the powerful Powhatan Confederacy. The Powhatan Confederacy was built by a charismatic leader who traveled between his many subject towns with an entourage of bodyguards and followers. His name was Wahunsanakawa. Through diplomacy, he held 30 nations together, and through military strength, he controlled the region. In 1607, an English ship sailed up Chesapeake Bay and into the lands of the Powhatan. The ship was captained by a soldier of fortune, John Smith. Hoping to be the first successful English colony in North America, the small but well-armed expedition landed at a place they would call Jamestown. As Jamestown took shape, Wahunsanakawa carefully weighed his options. He could destroy the settlement, but he was well aware of the power of European weapons and knew that an attack would be costly in Powhatan lives. Wahunsanakawa also saw the advantage of trade for European weapons and tools. He chose to watch and wait, monitoring the progress of the settlement through the eyes of his most trusted ally, his brother, Opishkankano, chief of the most powerful Powhatan nation, the Pamunkey. During their first winter, the colonists were barely able to provide for their basic needs, and many died. Opishkankano reported that the desperate English had begun entering Powhatan towns and taking food by force. Wahunsanakawa decided that he had to bring the colony under his direct control. He ordered the capture of John Smith and had the English captain brought before him. Present was Wahunsanakawa's favorite daughter, Pocahontas. The romantic story of Pocahontas saving Smith from death was undoubtedly an example of Smith's own creativity. His account of the incident, written immediately afterward, said nothing of his life being threatened. Only his memoirs, written 17 years later, included the story. In fact, in his memoirs, he claimed to have been saved from death at the last moment by beautiful women, no less than 3 times. In reality, it is probable that Wahunsanakawa cemented an alliance by proclaiming Smith leader of the Powhatan's newest subject town, Jamestown. Having established his supremacy and English submission, Wahunsanakawa released Smith. But as new people and supplies arrived from England, the colony tried a new tack to gain the upper hand. The English attempted to crown Wahunsanakawa King of the Powhatan, which would make him a subject king of England. But the coronation turned into a farce.
And a foul trouble there was to make him kneel to receive his crown. He neither knowing the majesty nor meaning of a crown, nor bending of the knee, endured so many persuasions, examples, and instruction as tired them all. At last, by leaning hard on his shoulders, he a little stooped, and Captain Newport put the crown on his head. John Smith, English captain.
The true balance of power was reflected in the trade between the two nations. The English were forced to pay extremely high prices in copper and trade goods for Powhatan food. New arrivals to the colony were shocked at the exchange rate, and the situation was an embarrassment to John Smith and the English. Finally, emboldened by an infusion of new weapons and men, Smith saw his chance to tilt the balance of power toward Jamestown. In January 1609, he took a military contingent into a Pamunkey town and seized Opishkankano and held him at gunpoint. His soldiers plundered the Pamunkey food stores, then demanded regular food tribute. If the Pamunkey did not comply, Smith promised to load his ships with their dead carcasses. Despite the assault, Wahunsanakawa strove to maintain the peace.
Why will you take by force what you may have quietly by love? Why will you destroy us who supply you with food? What can you get by war? We are unarmed and willing to give you what you ask if you come in a friendly manner and not with swords and guns. Wahunsanakawa, Powhatan.
But the English allowed for no diplomatic solution. No longer pretending to respect Powhatan authority, they used their weapons to take what they wanted, including Powhatan land. The survival of the Powhatan people at stake, Wahunsanakawa finally turned to war in August of 1609. It would continue unabated for 4 years. Then in April 1613, Pocahontas was kidnapped for the ransom of all English prisoners of war. The English captives were released, but Pocahontas remained a hostage. While held, she was indoctrinated daily in English customs and Anglican religion. Then the prisoner declared she had fallen in love with one of her captors, John Rolfe. The weary Wahunsanakawa agreed to a truce, hoping to see his daughter again.
I am not so simple as to not know that it is much better to eat good meat, sleep comfortably, laugh and be merry with the English, than to run away from them and lie cold in the woods, and to be so hunted that I can neither eat nor sleep. Wahunsanakawa, Powhatan.
Pocahontas was baptized Lady Rebecca, and peace was sealed with her marriage to John Rolfe. 2 years later, with their infant son, they sailed to England. Pocahontas was a sensation in London. She was shown in the best circles and presented to the king. But the woman billed as the right-thinking savage would not see her home again. She became ill, and in March of 1617, as she prepared to sail for Jamestown, Pocahontas died. She was 22 years old. With his lands shrinking, the death of his daughter finally broke Wahunsanakawa's heart. He relinquished power and died the following year. For Wahunsanakawa's brother, Opishkankano, the struggle continued and he faced a grave situation. The American practice of smoking tobacco was taking hold in England. Demand for Virginia tobacco gave Jamestown a cash crop and the need for more Powhatan land for cultivation. For the next 25 years, Opishkankano would lead the Powhatan in wars for their land and sovereignty. But by 1645, the struggle was becoming hopeless. The aged Opishkankano was carried into battle on a litter. He could not walk without help. He could not see without his servants holding his eyelids open. The last Powhatan war ended with the capture of the 90-year-old leader. Opeshkan Kano was murdered, shot in the back by an English guard. The powerful Powhatan Empire had proved unable to stem the tide of colonial expansion. On the little land that was left them, Powhatan people live to this day. Some descendants of the two brothers who guided their people through the first generation of contact. In 1619, a young Patuxet man named Tisquantum returned to his Massachusetts Bay village. But no mother or father or wife hurried to welcome him home. His village was deserted, the houses overgrown, and in the place of family and friends lay a field of bones. Five years earlier, Tisquantum had been captured by Englishmen and taken to Spain to be sold into slavery. Freed by Spanish priests, he made his way to England. From there, he worked his way back to North America as a guide and interpreter on an English ship. Tisquantum's village had been decimated by disease brought by the same English slavers who had abducted him. Now he stood in the shattered remnants of his home. This year there would be no ceremony of thanksgiving for the bounties of the earth and sea. No thanks for the corn, the wild turkeys and geese, the lobsters, walnuts and berries that were so plentiful. Tisquantum's long journey finally ended in Montope, capital of the neighboring Wampanoag Nation, themselves recovering from the ravages of European diseases. In December of the following year, 1620, a small English ship, the Mayflower, sailed into the Patuxet Bay. Landing at the site of Tisquantum's deserted village, the English renamed it Plymouth. Pilgrim's first winter was a hard one. Sickness and starvation reduced the 100 colonists by half. No Indian people came forward, and none could be found. With the coming of spring, the surviving pilgrims were amazed by the appearance of one Indian man who greeted them with the word, "Welcome." His name was Samoset.
He had learned some broken English among the Englishmen that came to fish at Monhegan. We questioned him of many things. He told us the place where we now live is called Patuxet, and that about 4 years ago, all the inhabitants died of an extraordinary plague, and there is neither man, woman, nor child remaining, as indeed we have found none, so that there is none to hinder our possession or lay claim unto it. William Bradford, Plymouth Colony.
Samoset left Plymouth and traveled to Montauk to bring word of the fledgling colony to the Wampanoag leader, Massasoit. Within days, Massasoit and an entourage set out on the trip to Plymouth. Samoset was sent ahead with someone whose English was even better than his own. Tisquantum, the last Patuxet, the one person who could truly call Plymouth home. Later that day, Massasoit arrived.
He was a very robust man in his best years, grave of countenance and spare of speech. His face was painted with a red, like mulberry, and he was oiled both head and face. William Bradford, Plymouth Colony.
Using Samoset and Tisquantum as interpreters, Massasoit negotiated a treaty with the Pilgrims for peace and mutual protection. Massasoit had reason to seek allies. The European epidemics had wiped out a vast majority of the Wampanoag people and neighboring nations. However, their powerful rivals to the west, the Narragansett, were left untouched. An alliance with the Pilgrims would help the Wampanoag regain their diplomatic strength.
Why would they want to have two enemies? The Narragansetts, whom they could probably consider to be their biggest threat, or these gnat-like English people that kept coming around the country, but they never seemed to stay before. Now all of a sudden they got a group of them that's building houses that have brought their families, women, first time English women have been in New England. Native logic would say, well, you don't bring your women where you're going to make war. So let's make peace with these people, use them as allies. They got their strange weapons, and if we make peace with them first, before anybody else does, then we'll have them on our side and we won't have to face their guns.
While Massasoit and his entourage returned to Montauk, Tisquantum remained with the Pilgrims on his beloved homeland and taught the new arrivals how to plant and where to fish. In the fall, 20 acres of Indian corn stood at Plymouth ready for harvest. And just as Tisquantum taught the Pilgrims to plant, he must have told them of the annual ceremony of Thanksgiving. A ceremony of thanks to celebrate the gifts of their world. The Pilgrims embraced the event and invited Massasoit and his Wampanoag to share their bounty. The Indian leader arrived with 90 of his people and 5 deer for the feast. For 3 days and nights, the celebration continued. Prayers and dances, alternating with shooting contests, wrestling matches, and games. The Thanksgiving of 1621 would be remembered as the Pilgrims' first. But for the Wampanoag, such a day of thanks had occurred from the beginning of time.
We believe that everything that was given to us was a gift from the Creator. So because it was a gift, we remembered to give thanks. And we did that in all of the ways that we could. And this was the basis of our ceremonial life. And because everything was a gift, we realized there was an obligation that comes with a gift, and that obligation was to share. Because if we didn't share, there was no reason for the Creator to continue to give us those gifts.
At the end of the first Thanksgiving, the Pilgrims and Wampanoag promised to make the feast an annual celebration of their harvests and friendship. But the relationship between the nations was destined to change.
We gave them unconditional acceptance and love and nurturement. That was, otherwise they would have been massacred at the beach.
When the English first came, my father was a great man and the English a little child. He constrained other Indians from harming the English. He gave the English corn and showed them how to plant. He let them have 100 times more land than now I have for my own people. King Philip, Wampanoag.
For almost 40 years, while the Plymouth colony rapidly expanded, Massasoit maintained peace between his Wampanoag and the English.
The Massasoit of the Wampanoag Nation, he was a magnificent peacekeeper. And that 50 years of peace maintained between us and the English was really due to his intelligence, integrity, and love for the people.
By the time of Massasoit's death in 1660, a new generation had risen to power in Plymouth. They had long forgotten his generosity. Leadership passed to Massasoit's 24-year-old son, Philip. He would become known as King Philip.
But then when Philip took over, he was a different sort of a person. He was going to fight to the end for his people.
In 1662, when King Philip came to power, the growing colonies held 50,000 residents. In New England, Indian nations found themselves surrounded. Their agricultural lands shrinking, many Wampanoag were left with little choice but to work for the English as laborers and servants. But it wasn't just land and liberty they were losing. Their culture and traditions were also under attack.
The English, they thought of Wampanoags as inferior from all the way around, from a standpoint, especially the religion. And then as a people, they were savages.
Zealous Puritans set out to convert them, pressuring many to abandon their homes and beliefs and to move to newly established praying towns. With little regard for the laws of the sovereign Wampanoag Nation, the English arrested King Philip's people for violating the Puritan code of ethics, the Blue Laws. Individuals were prosecuted for hunting and fishing on the Sabbath, for using Indian medicine, and entering into non-Christian marital unions.
The women, when we went out for our moon march and spent time alone or with our friends who also had their moon at the same time, and we sit out there in the woods alone chatting and purifying, they made laws against us that we couldn't do that, that we needed to be in the village, we needed to be working, except for on the Sabbath.
In Plymouth, Indian people were sentenced to death for denying the Christian religion.
Pray or be shot was the method of conversion. That's how the first Christian Indians had Christianity brought to them.
King Philip took an uncompromising stand against the repression.
You see this vast country before us, which the Creator gave to our fathers. You see these little ones, our wives and children. And you now see the foe before you. They have grown insolent and bold. All our ancient customs are disregarded. Treaties made by our fathers are broken. Our brothers murdered before our eyes. King Philip, Wampanoag.
15 years after his father's death, King Philip finally urged his people to war.
Our ancestor spirits cry to us for revenge. These people from the unknown world will cut down our groves, spoil our hunting and planting grounds, and drive us and our children from the graves of our fathers.
King Philip had no other choice because his land was being taken away. His people, the allegiance of his people, was being eroded. The war itself was not only over land, it was also over the right to follow our own traditions the Creator had given us.
On June 24th, 1675, King Philip's war began. In a brilliantly orchestrated series of forays, several English towns were caught off guard and burned to the ground by the Wampanoag and their allies.
An Indian never forgets a kindness, but he never forgives a wrong. And because there had been so much kindness shown during those good years between Massasoit, King Philip's father, and those settlers that came, King Philip never forgot any of those families had been close to he and his family. And he spared them. He actually even sent warnings to some of those families during the war that they were, their towns would be burned so they could escape with their families.
As Indian victories mounted, hysteria gripped the settlements. It was reported that Indian troops hung upon the fringes of the English towns like the lightning on the edge of clouds. On the side of a bridge over the Charles River, one of King Philip's men posted a taunting message.
Know by this paper that the Indians that you have provoked to wrath and anger will war. If you will, there are many Indians yet. You must consider the Indians lose nothing but their lives. You must lose your fair houses and cattle. James Nipmuc.
Through the fall and winter, fortune favored King Philip's forces. Then a series of defeats demoralized some Wampanoag allies.
The Great Swamp Massacre was where over 300 Native American old women and children were all burnt alive in their wigwams just 6 days before Christmas, December 19, 1675. And one historian recorded that the smell of burning flesh so moved one of the pilgrim soldiers that he later asked one of his superiors whether burning their enemies alive was consistent with the benevolent principles of the gospel.
The fortunes of war were turning. With the coming of spring, their winter food stores were depleted, and they were unable to plant or replenish their supplies. King Philip's people were starving, and English troops hunted them as though trailing a wounded animal. In May, the English attacked an allied Indian force camped above the falls on the Connecticut River. 300 Indian people were killed. Some managed to reach their canoes, but in their haste, left behind their paddles and were swept over the falls to their deaths. For the next 2 months, King Philip and his people evaded capture, but the noose was tightening. In August, English troops fell upon his camp, killing or capturing 173. King Philip narrowly escaped, but among those captured were his wife and 9-year-old son. In Plymouth, the clergy decided their fate. They were sold into slavery in Bermuda.
My heart breaks. Now, I am ready to die.
He would choose where he would die. King Philip returned to his home at Montauk, where his father, Massasoit, had often fed and entertained the pilgrims decades earlier. In the dawn light of August 12, 1676, an English and Indian army surrounded the sleeping camp. Moments later, King Philip was dead, shot through the heart by an Indian mercenary. King Philip's head was put on display in Plymouth, where it remained for the next 20 years.
We all have a purpose, a role in life, and the Creator, in his all of his wisdom, saw fit to spare us. We all could have been burned alive in the Great Swamp. We all could have been slaughtered in that war. But we were left here for a reason, and I believe that part of that reason is to be a conscience for this society, to prevent those same kinds of mistakes from continuing to be repeated over and over. That's what I see as my purpose, as the purpose of all of our Native people who will stand up and continue with that spirit that King Philip, Pontiac, Geronimo, all of our great leaders have had.
In our next program, we move to the interior of the continent, where the lands of the Indian nations were turned into battlefields, as the French, the English, and the American colonists all fought for supremacy. Please join us when 500 Nations returns for A Cauldron of War. Hello, I'm Kevin Costner. Welcome back to 500 Nations. Even before the colonies were established in the East, the European entrepreneurs of the New World started pushing west, testing the boundaries of this rich new land. What they discovered was the wealth of the Indian nations and the staggering abundance of their natural resources, the beautiful furs, the endless supply of deerskins. Indian people, in turn, saw that the goods the Europeans offered made life a lot easier. Metal axes, knives, copper kettles, and guns. And for a time, this simple arrangement worked. But very quickly, North America became an irresistible prize to the Europeans. They sent armies to fight for the control of the continent's resources, the way modern armies fight over oil. In this hour, we take you to the heartland, to a continent in turmoil. Welcome to Part 5 of 500 Nations, A Cauldron of War.
When the white man came here a stranger, he saw that the furs worn by our nations were valuable, and he showed to our ancestors many goods which he brought with him, and these were very tempting. The white man said, "Will you not sell the skins of your animals for the goods I bring?" Our ancestors replied, "We will buy your goods, and you will buy our furs." The whites proposed nothing more. Our ancestors acceded to nothing else. Potashah, Ojibwe.
In the 1600s, French and English fur traders made deep inroads into the North American continent, where interior Indian nations hunted beaver, mink, fox, and other fur-bearing animals. For northern Indian nations, trading with Europeans was merely an expansion of a seasonal round that had been repeated for centuries. Winter was the traditional time for villages to disperse into smaller groups to hunt and trap from winter camps. Spring was the season when they came back together and resumed village life. Hunters returned home with their winter's take of pelts and welcomed trade. At first, European traders conformed to this cycle, and the beautiful and exotic furs placed Indian traders in a strong bargaining position.
I heard my host, a Montagnier leader, say one day jokingly, "The beaver does everything perfectly well. It makes kettles, hatchets, swords, knives, bread. In short, it makes everything." He was making sport of us Europeans who have such a fondness for the skin of this animal. Nicolas Denis, fur trader.
Fur trade was becoming central to the European economy. From beaver came felt, and when the felt hat came into fashion in Europe, the North Atlantic trade took on global proportions.
It seemed like the European way of trading was to go out and try to outdo one another, who was going to have the most. And so our people were not like that with the other nations before the Europeans, but they soon caught on to be able to become wealthy that way.
Increasing demand and higher prices forced the fur trade to change, and along with it, the very structure of Indian nations. Many Indian people found it more lucrative to trade than to pursue old economic activities.
If you take a primitive tribe anywhere and present them with something that's going to make them live faster, have an easier life, they will take it. You know, the easy way. And by using the easy way, you're losing also your culture, because keeping your culture is not always easy.
Young men broke away from their traditional community roles to pursue commercial hunting in order to obtain goods that could only be gained through trade. Agricultural nations planted less. Fields lay fallow as pelts were used to purchase food from European traders. Ancient cultural and religious values came under attack, as the relationships between Indian people, the land, and animals changed through commercial hunting. Even European traders noted the transition.
Before, they killed animals only in proportion as they had need of them. They never made an accumulation of skins of moose, otter, beaver, or others, but only so far as they needed them for personal use.
Within decades, the animal populations of entire regions were completely exterminated.
In the past, there was none to barter with us that would have tempted us to waste our animals, as we did after the white people came on this island.
Nations who once traded in peace were forced into competition, even hostility, as hunters encroached upon the lands of others.
The times are exceedingly altered. The times have turned everything upside down, chiefly by the help of the white people. In times past, our forefathers lived in peace, love, and great harmony, and had everything in great plenty. But alas, it is not so now. All our fishing, hunting, and fowling is entirely gone. Harry Quadwaqueet, Monhegan.
Adherence to traditional values was further eroded by the greatest of all scourges that flowed from trade, alcohol. A British trader observed,
"They do not call it drinking unless they become drunk. Immediately after taking everything with which they can injure themselves from the houses, the women carry it into the woods, where they go to hide with all their children. After that, the men have a fine time, beating, injuring, and killing one another."
With each generation, alcohol cut deeper into the social fabric of Indian nations. In 1803 alone, 21,000 gallons of rum flowed into the interior.
We are meant to deliberate upon what? Upon no less a subject than whether we shall or shall not be a people. The tyrant is no native to our soil, but is the pernicious liquid which our pretended white friends artfully introduced and so plentifully pours among us. Creek Speaker.
Trade also brought a deadly killer that went unrecognized until the 20th century. Indian nations had long traditions in painting and paint making, and few pigments were as highly prized as red ochre. When European traders introduced brilliant red vermilion paint, it became widely used for facial and body decoration. But the paint was made from lead and mercury, hidden poisons that may have struck down thousands.
Such was the agreement made by my ancestors with the white man. They hunted for the white man, and before many years, the game grew scarce. And the benefits we derive from this agreement are these. Instead of using a stone to cut my wood, I used a sharp axe. Instead of being clothed in my own warm, ancient clothing, I used that which comes from across the big water. Instead of having plenty of food, I am always hungry. And instead of being sober, the Indians are drunk.
Along the South Atlantic coast, one small Indian nation would take their economic destiny into their own hands. In 1670, the English founded Charleston on land belonging to the Siwi, or islanders. Charleston emerged as the economic heart of the southern colonies, built on a thriving trade in deer hides with the Siwi and neighboring nations.
In the late 1600s, with the founding of Charleston, the whole economy revolved around the Indian trade. The men who lived along Goose Creek became the big traders who would go into the interior, trading with the Indians, trading all manner of manufactured goods and beads, but primarily to get deer skins, which were being used for all kinds of purposes.
The financial success of the Charleston traders did not extend to their Indian suppliers, who typically received only 5% of what buyers in England paid for their hides. The Siwi were determined to be treated fairly. An English observer reported,
"Seeing that the ships always came in at one place made them very confident that that way was the exact road to England. And seeing so many ships come thence, they believed it could not be far." John Lawson, Surveyor General.
The Siwi believed that by rowing to the distant point on the horizon where ships first appeared, they would be able to find their way to England. Once there, they could establish direct trade, eliminating the expensive middlemen. Preparations were secretly begun.
It was agreed upon immediately to make an addition of their fleet by building more canoes, and those to be of the best sort and biggest size, as fit for their intended discovery. Some Indians were employed about making the canoes, others to hunting, everyone to the post he was most fit for, all endeavors tending towards an able fleet and cargo for Europe. John Lawson, Surveyor General.
After months of preparation, the canoes were loaded with hides, pelts, and the most valuable possessions of the Siwi nation. All able-bodied men and women boarded the vessels and launched into the surf, leaving behind only the children, the sick, and the very old. The Siwi nation had become a flotilla. But as they entered open ocean, their fragile endeavor turned disastrous. A gale blew up. High seas engulfed the Siwi canoes. Those strong enough to survive were not the fortunate ones. They were rescued by a passing English slave ship, only to be delivered to the auction block in the West Indies. In an instant, the Siwi nation ceased to exist. Its people had become a commodity. They were not alone. Indian slaves, along with deer hides and rum, formed the basis of the southern colonial economy.
In Charleston, South Carolina, the slave trade really started with the selling of Indians, and everything that we see later with the African Americans who were sold there was going on in the 1600s and 1700s with the Indians. They would be brought into market, they would be put up on a block, they would be auctioned off.
Many Indian slaves were kept for the home economy in the South, or shipped to New England. Most were sent to Barbados, the Bahamas, Jamaica, and other Caribbean outposts to work the sugar plantations. Life in servitude was brutal and short, and as Indian slaves succumbed to violence, disease, and harsh working conditions, African slaves were imported to take their place.
Africans and Indians were basically being treated as animals. Even though the Catholic Church had recognized the humanity of the Indians, most of the conquerors who came over did not recognize them as human beings, and they treated them the same way they would wild horses or cows, by branding them, by chaining them, by making them march in long lines chained to one another, and then by selling them in an auction block. You could see an Indian being sold in an auction block the same way you could see cows or horses or a mule being sold.
As late as 1730, one quarter of the slaves in some southern colonies were still Indian people.
They took a part of my tribe and sold them to the Spaniards in Bermuda. But I would speak, and I could wish it might be like the voice of thunder. that it might be heard afar off even to the ends of the earth. He that will advocate slavery is worse than a beast. And he that will not set his face against its corrupt principles is a coward and not worthy of being numbered among men. William Avis, Pequot.
You British and the French are like the two edges of a pair of shears, and we are the cloth which is cut to pieces between them. Odawa.
By the mid-1700s, the Indian nations of the eastern interior were surrounded by European powers. Spain controlled Florida. The English were pressing in from their colonies in the east, and the French were aggressively moving across the Great Lakes and along the Mississippi River. Spurred by the increasingly lucrative fur trade, along with valuable farmlands, North America was seen by the Europeans as a commercial prize. To win it, the French and English established military outposts throughout the interior to support their trading ventures and solidify their claims to the land.
This idea of encroachment and land ownership and so forth was so foreign to us that we couldn't understand it. As individuals, we couldn't understand it. It was carving up our mother's breast. It was parceling out the land and the air above it to individual ownership.
In 1754, France and England clashed for control over the continent in what would become known as the French and Indian War. From Europe, the American conflict was seen as a distant chess match for territory, power, and trade, with Indian nations mere fighting pawns. But in America, the interior Indian nations saw their homelands turned into violent battlegrounds.
Why do not you and the French fight in the old country and on the sea? Why do you come to fight in our land? Shingas Lenape.
Most Indian nations joined the war on the side of the French.
We had a very close affinity to the French people. The reason is because they had no designs on our territory. They were not out to colonize. If they wanted to live with us, they married into the tribe, and they lived with us, and they were welcome. On the other hand, at the other end of the scale, the English are notorious for being colonists. They don't want the sun to set on the British Empire, so they want colonies everywhere. And this new world was no different. That's why they came.
In 1760, after 6 years of war, the French shocked their Indian allies in the Ohio Valley and the Western Great Lakes by abruptly withdrawing from the region. While the French continued to fight for other parts of the continent, here the English army moved into their abandoned forts unopposed.
Englishmen, although you have conquered the French, you have not yet conquered us. We are not your slaves. These lakes, these woods and mountains were left to us by our ancestors. They are our inheritance, and we will part with them to none.
One Odawa man, who had fought alongside the French, then watched them retreat, refused to abandon the struggle. His name was Pontiac.
On the night he was born, there was snow and rain and winds. There was lightning and thunder, and there were shooting stars. And all of the phenomena that was taking place that night, the elders said that there was a great person being born.
While many leaders saw the English as a threat to their nations, Pontiac saw the English as a threat to all Indian people. Nations had to put aside the past and unite in common purpose. Pontiac's vision would change the thinking of Indian leaders for generations.
So what he did was to organize his own thoughts and then organize his own people and then other tribes
got them together with what undoubtedly had to be great oratory and great diplomatic moves and skills to get people, some of whom were his bitter enemies, our tribe's bitter enemies. We fought the Hurons for hundreds of years. We fought the Shawnees. We fought many of these tribes. He went around and got them to become part of what's known as Pontiac's Confederacy.
It is important for us, my brothers, that we exterminate from our land this nation which only seeks to kill us. When I go to the English chief to tell him that some of our comrades are dead, instead of weeping, he makes fun of me and of you. When I ask him for something for our sick, he refuses and tells me that he has no need of us. There is no more time to lose, and when the English shall be defeated, we shall cut off the passage so they cannot come back to our country. Pontiac, Odawa.
Fighting men from the Anishinaabe, Miami, Seneca, Lenape, Shawnee, and other nations responded to his call. In May 1763, Pontiac's rebellion erupted with the siege of Fort Detroit. Over the next 2 months, 9 of the 11 English forts in the region fell. Only Detroit and Fort Pitt remained in British hands, both under siege by Pontiac's alliance.
And he started taking the British forts, and he took them one by one, cut off the security of the colonists. Then they were on their own. Then his vision was that once we get the last one, once we get Detroit, we will start and we will just kind of herd them ahead of us like ducks or geese, right back to the Atlantic Ocean.
Pontiac stood on the verge of total victory. With France still in control of Louisiana and the Mississippi, local French residents assured him that French forces would soon return to the region to help him drive out the English once and for all. But unknown to Pontiac, France had already signed a treaty of surrender in Paris, ending all hostilities between the two colonial powers in North America. Rumors of the accord reached Pontiac in June, at the height of his triumph, but he refused to believe that the French would not respond to his victories. The British army, freed from campaigns against the French, launched massive expeditions against the Indian forces. But Pontiac's alliance held their ground. Increasingly desperate to prevail, British commander Geoffrey Amherst put a bounty on Pontiac's head, then proposed a sinister tactic, germ warfare.
Could it not be contrived to send the smallpox among those disaffected tribes of Indians? We must, on this occasion, use every stratagem in our power to reduce them. You will do well to try to inoculate the Indians by means of blankets, to try to extirpate this execrable race.
Shawnee, Lenape, and Odawa were crippled by smallpox-infested blankets from Fort Pitt.
Pretty soon burst out a terrible sickness among us. Lodge after lodge was totally vacated. Nothing but the dead bodies lying here and there in their lodges. Entire families being swept off with the ravages of this terrible disease.
In October, confirmation of the French surrender reached Pontiac and his allies. The news was a decisive blow to the momentum of the rebellion. Now they knew that help would never come. Pontiac called off the siege of Detroit and retired with his people to their winter camps. The next spring, he tried to rally forces for another push against the English, but his efforts were ineffective. Many Indian nations were encouraged by English promises that settlements would never be allowed on their land. They were also anxious to normalize relations and to resume European trade. With the passage of another year, Pontiac was a leader without a following. His moment had passed. The British forts were there to stay. In 1769, only 6 years after the incredible success of his campaign against the British, Pontiac died, murdered in the ancient Indian center of Cahokia. But his life had not been in vain. His vision of united Indian nations would echo through the region and across the coming decades.
The idea didn't die. The idea that Pontiac had implanted with these other leaders and these other tribes prevailed.
Pontiac's life was a message to the future. But before the nations of the Great Lakes and Ohio Valley would rise again, the continent would be embroiled in another costly war, this time between the American colonists and their king.
The Iroquois laugh when you talk to them of obedience to kings, for they cannot reconcile the idea of submission with the dignity of man. Each individual is a sovereign in his own mind, and as he conceives he derives his freedom from the Creator alone, he cannot be induced to acknowledge any other power. John Long, fur trader.
The Europeans, their point of view on our people is that we didn't really exist as a people, as a structured people, until they came. You know, but really, when you research back into our history, you're going to find that we were already structured and with governments intact, and our whole way of life was already intact.
The oldest democracy in North America was created by five Indian nations in what is today New York State. The Onondaga, Oneida, Mohawk, Seneca, and Cayuga. Together they became known as the Iroquois. They called themselves the Haudenosaunee. The Haudenosaunee Confederacy was born in a violent era centuries before the French and Indian War. At that time, a vicious cycle of war and revenge was running out of control among the five nations. In the midst of the chaos, a visionary man from the Huron Nation appeared. Rather than a war club and arrows, he carried teachings. He would be known as the Peacemaker. The Peacemaker proposed a set of laws by which people and nations could live in peace and unity. A system of self-rule guided by moral principles known as the Great Law.
In all your acts, self-interest shall be cast away. Look and listen for the welfare of the whole people, and have always in view not only the present, but also the coming generations, the unborn of the future nation.
When the great peacemaker designed the Confederacy and its laws, he brought together five warring nations into one heart, one body, one mind, and he symbolized it by using five arrows when he bound it together to make it a strong union. He said, when you pull one arrow out, it's easily broken. He broke one in half in front of them, just to show them. And so he told them, he said, if you all stick together in union, then you will never be broken.
The first wampum belt was created to symbolize the Great Law. The image embodied the dream that became a reality. Five nations, independent, but joined together as one. The Great Law was both a set of moral teachings and a concrete plan for a democratic union built around the social structures of the nations. Each nation had long been organized into clans, which served as extended families. Clans lived together in longhouses, which were owned by the women of the clans. Up to 200 feet in length, longhouses sheltered as many as a dozen families, with private areas and shared fires. They were a place of security, a warm refuge against harsh winters. Clan membership passed from mother to child. When a child came of age, they would marry into another clan. In this way, the entire nation was woven into one greater family. From this clan structure, the Haudenosaunee built a representative democracy. The women of each clan would appoint one man as clan chief. In this way, leadership would rise through trust rather than conquest. The clan chiefs of each of the five nations gathered at the Haudenosaunee capital of Onondaga to form the Grand Council. Governing from the heart of their territory, the Grand Council envisioned all five nations as sheltered by a giant longhouse stretching 250 miles. The longhouse's central aisle was the Haudenosaunee Trail, the principal line of communication between the members of the League. The eastern door of the domain was guarded by the Mohawk. The Seneca watched the door to the west, and the Onondaga were the center, the keepers of the fire. The Democratic Confederacy, envisioned by the peacemaker, preserved peace for centuries.
When the Europeans arrived in the territory of the Haudenosaunee in the early 1600s, the process of protocol that the peacemaker had given to us was in place. So we were able to deal with those Europeans on a political basis.
In 1754, Benjamin Franklin attended a conference with the Haudenosaunee in Albany, New York. He came away inspired by the successful model of independent states united under one rule of law. Soon after, he would propose a similar union of colonies. 22 years later, these United States would declare their independence from England. In that year, 1776, events swirled toward the American Revolution. 10,000 strong and strategically located between the colonies and the British in Canada, the Haudenosaunee were seen as a key to victory. British and American diplomats met repeatedly with representatives of the Grand Council, trying to pull the Indian nations to their side. But the Grand Council, guided by the principles of peace laid down by the Great Law, declared their neutrality. Although they would not ally with either power, in a diplomatic gesture, a delegation from the Grand Council traveled to Philadelphia. There, the Haudenosaunee, the oldest democracy in North America, officially recognized the fledgling American government. The delegation had been lodged in Independence Hall, above the chamber of the Continental Congress, where representatives were drafting the Declaration of Independence. During that same critical summer of 1776, a young Mohawk named Joseph Brant returned from England. A protege of the British agent for Indian Affairs, Sir William Johnson, Brant's family had long-standing ties to the British. Traveling among the Haudenosaunee nations, Brant passionately argued for an alliance with the British as their only hope to prevent being overrun by the Americans.
He started to go amongst the nations of the Mohawks, the Oneidas, the Onondagas, Cayugas, and Senecas, trying to entice the young men to go on the side of the British.
In an act that threatened the very existence of the Confederacy, Joseph Brant, in open defiance of the Grand Council, called a meeting in the summer of 1777 to argue the British case. Blacksnake, a young Haudenosaunee man from the Seneca Nation, listened closely.
Brant came forward and said that if we did nothing for the British, there would be no peace for us. Our throats would be cut by the Redcoat Man or by America. That we should go and join the Father. This is the way for us.
Black Snake's uncle, a respected Seneca leader named Corn Planter, rose to challenge Brant. Corn Planter was a veteran of the French and Indian Wars and had participated in the critical council decisions of his time. He wanted no part of a war that was not his to fight.
You must all mark and listen to what I have to say. War is war. Death is death. A fight is a hard business. Here America says not to lift our hands against either party. I move, therefore, to wait a little while to hear more consultation between the two parties. Let the British say everything he is going to say to us. We then can see clear where we are going and not be deceived. Corn Planter, Seneca.
In shocked disbelief, Black Snake and the others watched as Brant rose to his feet. He ordered Corn Planter to stop speaking, then called him a coward.
The men had a great deal of controversy among themselves, with some for Brant and some for Corn Planter. They began to say that we must fight for somebody, because they could not bear to be called cowards.
The following day, the gathering, predominantly Mohawk and Seneca, broke with the Grand Council and agreed to fight with the British. Corn Planter resigned himself to the majority will and rallied his men.
Every brave man show himself now. Hereafter we will find our many dangerous times. I therefore say to you, you must stand like good soldiers against your own white brother. Because just as soon as he finds out that you are against him, he will show no mercy on us.
But as factions broke from the Grand Council, not all joined the British. The Oneida, heavily influenced by American missionaries, were moving toward an outright alliance with the Americans. The horror of civil war loomed over the Confederacy. In the midst of the American Revolution, a Haudenosaunee civil war began. On August 6, 1777, Oneida fighting men and their American allies clashed at Oriskany Creek with British troops and their Seneca and Mohawk allies. At day's end, hundreds lay dead on the battlefield. As the war raged across the eastern continent, Mohawk and Seneca forces allied with the British wreaked havoc on frontier settlements, draining American economic and military resources away from the war effort. In retaliation, George Washington sent an army against the Haudenosaunee capital at Onondaga. One nation still clinging tenaciously to neutrality. After Washington's army ransacked the capital, the Onondaga also plunged angrily into the war on the side of the British.
You call George Washington the father of your country. We call George Washington Onondagas, which means town destroyer.
In August 1779, Washington sent General John Sullivan into Haudenosaunee country with 5,000 men. Entering territory few white men had ever even seen, Sullivan carved a chilling swath of destruction, forcing those in his path to flee their homes. Sullivan's soldiers could not help but marvel at the prosperity of the deserted towns they were destroying.
We reached the town, which consisted of 128 houses, mostly very large and elegant.
The Indians live much better than most of the Mohawk River farmers.
their houses very well furnished with all necessary household utensils, great plenty of grain, several horses, cows, and wagons.
It appears to be a very old settlement. There are a great number of apple and peach trees here, which we cut down and destroyed.
A group of Haudenosaunee mercenaries who guided Sullivan's army into the territory were captured by the Seneca. One man recognized his own brother among the captives.
Brother, you have merited death. When those rebels had drove us from the fields of our fathers to seek out new homes, it was you who would dare to step forth as their pilot and conduct them to the doors of our homes to butcher our children and put us to death. No crime can be greater. But though you have merited death and shall die on this spot, my hand shall not be stained in the blood of a brother. Who will strike?
A Seneca chief killed the prisoner instantly. But even the powerful Seneca could not stand against Sullivan's massive army. Old and young grabbed what few possessions they could carry and fled.
A part of our corn they burnt and threw the remainder into the river. They burnt our houses, killed what few cattle and horses they could find, destroyed our fruit trees, and left nothing but the bare soil. What were our feelings when we found that there was not a mouthful of any kind of sustenance left? Not even enough to keep a child one day from perishing with hunger. Dickawamas, Seneca.
In retaliation for the American destruction of Onondaga, Mohawk, Seneca, and Cayuga villages, Joseph Brant attacked the Oneida and neighboring Tuscarora, allies of the Americans. In the end, all of the five nations were ravaged. Out of scores of Haudenosaunee towns, only two survived unscathed. And it was already fall, with no way to replace the lost crops. The tragedy heightened with the coming of winter. It was the coldest in memory. Snow fell 5 feet deep. Many homeless Haudenosaunee died of hunger, cold, and disease. Less than 4 years later, in 1783, the British government surrendered at the Treaty of Paris. With no concern for the sovereignty of Indian nations, even their allies, the British ceded control of the continent as far west as the Mississippi to the new American nation. In post-war treaties, the United States government seized vast Haudenosaunee lands, even those belonging to their allies, the Oneida, whose women had brought life-saving corn and blankets to George Washington's starving troops at Valley Forge. But the five nations of the Haudenosaunee would heal the wounds of civil war and remain defiant. In 1790, they forced concessions from the United States at the Treaty of Canandaigua, which allowed them to keep their core homelands. The Haudenosaunee would survive and rebuild, drawn together by the Great Law and their Grand Council. A union that endures to this day.
If the Haudenosaunee was destroyed at the Revolutionary War, then why am I sitting here? We were not destroyed. Our council fire still remained. Our council's fire has remained all of these years. And the history and the culture of the Haudenosaunee, its political and spiritual structure is still intact. And we sit here traveling around the world on our own passports as sovereign people. We were not destroyed by the Revolutionary War.
No sooner had the United States come into being than its people, hungry for new land and opportunity, poured west across the Appalachian Mountains to open up the new frontier. But imagine the movement as the Indian people must have seen it. This was their home, where their ancestors were buried, where they were raising their children. They had already experienced the disruptions of trade, alcohol, missionaries, disease, and war. Now their lands were at stake. Indian people fought to preserve their freedom, and in their aggressive defense, stories of frontier violence came to define them as hostiles and savages. Armed with this distorted image, the same cycle that had dispossessed the Indian nations of the East was underway again. We begin part six in the Ohio River Valley, where in the atmosphere of frontier chaos, one of the great leaders of North America would emerge with a message of hope. His name was Tecumseh, and he would try to change the course of history.
When we passed through the country between Pittsburgh and our nations, lately Shawnee and Lenape hunting grounds, where we could once see nothing but deer and buffalo, we found the country thickly inhabited and the people under arms. We were compelled to make a detour of 300 miles. We saw large numbers of white men in forts and fortifications around Salt Springs and Buffalo Grounds. Cornstalk, Shawnee.
In the aftermath of the American Revolution, the lands of the powerful Haudenosaunee nations were shrunk to little more than reservation islands. The front lines of the invasion moved west to the nations of the Ohio Valley, the Lenape, Shawnee, Miami, and others. Settlers flooded west. Many of them, Revolutionary War veterans, paid with land grants by the government left bankrupt from the war. Supported by the new United States, they came prepared to fight for the land.
The people of our frontier carry on private expeditions against the Indians and kill them whenever they meet them. And I do not believe there is a jury in all Kentucky who would punish a man for it. John Hamtramck, Major, United States Army.
Over the next 20 years, through a series of battles and dubious treaties, the new United States laid claim to Indian lands on the frontier. Vast tracts were ceded to white settlement, including the future sites of Detroit, Toledo, Peoria, and Chicago.
My heart is a stone, heavy with sadness for my people, cold with the knowledge that no treaty will keep whites out of our lands, hard with the determination to resist as long as I live and breathe. Blue Jacket, Shawnee.
In this atmosphere of despair and frontier violence, missionaries undermined the cultural and religious values of Indian communities.
Our life is who we are, our identity, our language, our ceremonies, our way of how we used to dress and how we related to each other. Those are the makeup, part of the makeup of our people. And so when Christianity came about, it started to change. They were trying to make us become what we were not.
You have got our country, but are not satisfied. You want to force your religion upon us. The Creator has made us all, but He has made a great difference between us. He has given us a different complexion and different customs. Since He has made so great a difference between us in other things, why may we not conclude that He has given us a different religion according to our understanding? We do not wish to destroy your religion or take it from you. We only want to enjoy our own. Red Jacket, Seneca.
But the pressure on Indian people was unrelenting. their land, livelihood, culture, and very beliefs under attack. Frustrated warriors traded scarce resources for alcohol.
And now reality's in your face. You're slapped in the face reality. What's the best way to escape that kind of reality? During those times, our people began to take up the rum to numb their feelings, because that feeling, that hurt, was so strong.
The men revel in strong drink and are very quarrelsome. The families become frightened and move away for safety. Now the drunken men run yelling through the village and have weapons to injure those whom they meet. Now there are no doors in the houses, for they have all been kicked off. Now we men full of strong drink alone track there. Handsome Lake, Seneca.
One young Shawnee man, Lalawetika, like many demoralized young men of his generation, had succumbed to alcoholism. He was completely dependent on his older brother, Tecumseh. Tecumseh and Lalawetika had grown up in the world of frontier violence. Their father was killed fighting the British. Their older brother died at the hands of Tennessee settlers. The village of their birth had been laid waste by Kentuckians. Now, in 1803, determined to maintain his traditions, Tecumseh led Lalawetika and the people of their village west into Indiana in an effort to put distance between themselves and white settlers. But in Indiana, Lalawetika's drinking worsened. He sank into a deep depression. But his life was about to turn around. One day, while in his home, Lalawetika fell to the floor. For a time, Tecumseh and others in the village believed he was dead. But he was not dead. Lalawetika had had a revelation, a divine message that responded to the unbearable conditions of his people. Suddenly and clearly, he saw a path for renewal. Abandon the ways of the white man and return to the old teachings. From that moment forward, Lalawetika would be known as Tenskwatawe, the Shawnee prophet. Tenskwatawe never drank again, and he urged his followers to shun alcohol and all other ideas and things that came from white men.
Have you not heard at evenings, and sometimes in the dead of night, those mournful sounds that steal through the deep valleys and along the mountainsides? These are the wailings of those spirits whose bones have been turned up by the plow of the white man and left to the mercy of the rain and wind. Tenskwatawe, Shawnee.
Tenskwatawe promised that if the people returned to their own ways, the whites would be pushed back and prosperity would return. Tecumseh embraced his brother's vision of cultural renewal, and together they spread the message to every Ohio Valley nation. Hundreds traveled to Indiana to hear them speak in person. Shawnee, Odawa, Wyandot, Kickapoo, and other families converged on a new settlement established by the prophet and Tecumseh near the intersection of the Wabash and Tippecanoe Rivers, Prophetstown. Tenskwatawe preached to visitors in the council house every night, followed by dancing and singing. White frontiersmen claimed to be able to hear the drums all night long. But it would be Tecumseh who would challenge the course of history by transforming his brother's message into a political and military movement. Using Prophetstown as his base, Tecumseh would emerge the most powerful Indian leader of his time.
brothers. We are friends. We must assist each other to bear our burdens. The blood of many of our fathers and brothers has run like water on the ground to satisfy the avarice of the white men. We ourselves are threatened with a great evil. Nothing will pacify them but the destruction of all the red men. Tecumseh, Shawnee.
In 1808, while the Shawnee prophet, Tenskwatawe, preached cultural renaissance at Prophetstown, his brother, Tecumseh, traveled throughout the territory spreading the prophet's message along with a political and military vision of his own.
The whites have driven us from the sea to the lakes. We can go no farther. The way, the only way, to stop this evil is for us to unite in claiming a common and equal right in the land, as it was at first and should be now. For it was never divided, but belongs to all. Unless every tribe unanimously combines to give a check to the ambition and avarice of the whites, they will soon conquer us apart and disunited, and we will be driven away from our native country and scattered as autumnal leaves before the wind. Tecumseh, Shawnee.
Tecumseh electrified his audiences. At one gathering, a nervous white observer reported seeing young men shaking with emotion, 1,000 tomahawks brandished in the air. William Henry Harrison, governor of the Indiana Territory, recognized Tecumseh's personal power and charisma and saw the Shawnee leader as a singular threat.
The implicit obedience and respect which the followers of Tecumseh pay to him is really astonishing, and more than any other circumstance, bespeaks him one of those uncommon geniuses which spring up occasionally to produce revolutions and overturn the established order of things. If it were not for the vicinity of the United States, he would perhaps be the founder of an empire that would rival in glory that of Mexico or Peru. Governor William Henry Harrison.
Prophetstown's population swelled. But, despite Tecumseh's growing influence, he could not control the actions of all Indian leaders. In 1809, at one of many treaty conferences, Governor Harrison convinced leaders of the Miami, Lenape, and Potawatomi to sell 3 million acres of land in Indiana and Illinois. Tecumseh was outraged, considering those who signed the treaty guilty of treason.
No tribe has the right to sell a country, even to each other, much less to strangers. Sell a country? Why not sell the air? The great sea as well as the earth. Did not the Great Spirit make them all for the use of his children?
Tecumseh went to Harrison and, in a volatile meeting, confronted the governor face to face.
Brother, I look at the land and pity the women and children. I am authorized to say that they want to save that piece of land. We do not wish you to take it. It is small enough for our purposes. I want the present boundary line to continue. Should you cross it, I assure you it will be productive of bad consequences.
But the settlements continued to expand, even onto the newly ceded lands. Tecumseh was convinced that only force would stop the American advance. To build a military resistance, he continued to travel tirelessly among the nations of the Great Lakes and Ohio Valley, while Harrison kept a nervous eye on his movements.
No difficulties deter him. For 4 years, he has been in constant motion. You see him today on the Wabash, and in a short time you hear of him on the shores of Lake Erie or Michigan or the banks of the Mississippi. And wherever he goes, he makes an impression favorable to his purpose.
In 1811, Tecumseh traveled south in an effort to bring the powerful Choctaw, Chickasaw, and Creek into the alliance. There, in village after village, he argued that Indian nations stood at the brink of disaster.
Where today are the powerful tribes of our people? They have vanished before the avarice and oppression of the white man, as snow before the summer sun. Will we let ourselves be destroyed in our turn, without making an effort worthy of our race? Shall we, without a struggle, give up our homes, our lands, the graves of our dead, and everything that is dear and sacred to us? I know you will say with me, never. Never!
But Tecumseh's passion and presence alone could not overcome a growing cultural rift. Many southern Indian leaders were encouraging their nations to emulate mainstream white society. Others saw military conflict with the U.S. as suicide. Although Tecumseh found passionate supporters everywhere, his hope that southern nations would join in a unified resistance was not to be. In January of 1812, Tecumseh returned to Indiana to find Prophetstown destroyed, its people dispersed. Governor Harrison had waited until Tecumseh, the military leader of the movement, had departed for the South before moving on Prophetstown. But Tenskwatawe, with a much smaller force, attacked the Americans before they reached the town, allowing the residents to evacuate. The following day, Harrison entered the deserted town on the Tippecanoe River and burned it to the ground. Although his army suffered twice the casualties of the Indian force, Harrison claimed a victory that would eventually propel him to the presidency. Despite the loss of Prophetstown, Tecumseh and the Prophet began immediately to rebuild their movement. Then the War of 1812 broke out between the British and United States. Suddenly there was a new opportunity to push back the Americans through an alliance with the British. The two brothers moved north to Canada with 1,000 men. There they were joined by allies from throughout the Ohio Valley and Great Lakes. After years of tireless effort, Tecumseh's unified resistance was now a reality. The British and Indian force laid siege to the fort at Detroit, quickly forcing its surrender. American forts fell at Mackinac and Dearborn. In January of 1813, Tecumseh and his allies forced the surrender of the Americans at Frenchtown. Tecumseh hoped to push the campaign into the Ohio Valley. But the following May, British and Indian forces suffered their first defeat. Then, during the summer, the war began to turn against them, and Tecumseh could see the British will failing. He confronted the British commander, General Proctor.
You always told us that you would never draw your foot off British ground, but now we see you are drawing back. We are very much astonished to see you tying up everything and preparing to run away, without letting us know what your intentions are.
Without informing their Indian allies, the British made plans to abandon Detroit as a large American force approached. At the head of the American army rode the man who destroyed Prophetstown, Governor William Henry Harrison. Tecumseh demanded that General Proctor make a stand.
Listen. We wish to remain here and fight our enemy. You have got the arms and ammunition. If you have an idea of going away, give them to us, and you may go and welcome. As for us, our lives are in the hands of the Creator. We are determined to defend our lands, and if it be His will, we wish to leave our bones upon them. Tecumseh, Shawnee.
Faced with Harrison's 3,000-man army, Tecumseh was forced to fall back with the British, 80 miles. They halted their retreat along the Thames River. There, Tecumseh would make his stand. On October 5th, 1813, the Shawnee leader rallied his men as he inspected the lines from horseback. He urged General Proctor to do the same.
Tell your men to be firm, and all will be well.
Tecumseh dismounted and joined his troops at their position in a swampy thicket. The night before, he had had a premonition about the battle, and in it, he had foreseen his death. Tecumseh removed the scarlet British military jacket he always wore and dressed in traditional Shawnee clothes. He handed his sword to a trusted friend and instructed him to give it to his son when he grew up and to tell him what his father stood for. In mid-afternoon, Harrison's cavalry charged. The British lines immediately collapsed and ran, with the British general on horseback passing his own troops as they fled. Tecumseh did not run, and neither did his men. From a nearby hillside, the Shawnee prophet watched as the Americans charged his brother's position. Tecumseh received a gunshot wound to the chest and fell. 30 minutes later, the battle was over. For the Ohio Valley nations, the eventual British defeat in the War of 1812 would simply underscore the tragic loss of Tecumseh. In the years before the war, he had traveled the Indian road stretching in every direction from Prophetstown. In every village, his warning had been the same. The Americans will not stop until they have taken all our land. Tecumseh had seen the future.
While strong, it has been our obvious policy to weaken them. Now that they are weak and harmless and most of their lands fallen into our hands, they must be taught to improve their condition. William Clark, Superintendent of Indian Affairs.
For decades, federal agents and Christian missionaries had pressured Indian nations to abandon their traditions and assimilate into white society. The policy, promoted by Thomas Jefferson and others after him, advocated intermarriage, religious conversion, and financial incentives to turn Indian people into Americanized farmers. In the South, U.S. policy was succeeding. Traditionals had been eliminated as a serious military threat, and American culture was spreading. The large southern nations, the Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Creek, and Seminole, came to be known as the five civilized tribes. To the Americans, the most civilized of these were the Cherokee.
We call ourselves Ameyawiya, which is translated into the principal people. When the Creator made the world, He created these beautiful mountains here in the Smokies. And He needed someone to live here, someone who would take care of what He'd made and what He gave to us. So He chose the Cherokee people.
The ancient Cherokee nation flourished in and around the Great Smoky Mountains, building their capital of Echota in the foothills southwest of present-day Knoxville, Tennessee. Echota was a peace town where no one could be harmed. But with each passing generation, there were fewer and fewer who clung to the traditional Cherokee lifeway. Many Cherokee became successful modeling themselves after their American neighbors, living in two-story houses on plantations, raising European crops, owning slaves, and educating their children in American schools. In 1817, a new national council formed with wealthy landowner John Ross as its principal elected chief. The centuries-old clan-based government was replaced with a Republican state modeled after the American system. Echota, the venerated Cherokee peace town, was replaced as seat of government by New Echota in Georgia. In 1821, a man named Sequoia completed an alphabet that committed the Cherokee language to writing. Soon they had their own newspaper, the Cherokee Phoenix. But despite Cherokee efforts to coexist and United States government policies to bring Indian nations into the American way, it was a relationship marred by racism and greed. In the middle of a booming slave economy built around cotton, demand for land was growing. And the southern Indian nations still controlled vast areas. In 1828, Andrew Jackson, like William Henry Harrison, used his reputation as an Indian fighter to propel himself to the presidency.
Greed, usually, is a thing that makes people do things they wouldn't do otherwise. Gold was discovered down in Georgia.
Hundreds of miners illegally swarmed across the Cherokee border to lay claim to the vein. The Cherokee turned to the United States for protection. But President Jackson, himself a land speculator, removed federal troops from the area, telling Georgia officials, "Build a fire under the Cherokee. When it gets hot enough, they'll move."
The greed of the white man grew, and the first thing that came into his mind was, "We must obtain this land at any cost." And that idea of the removal started there.
For the Indian people who believed their salvation lay in emulating American society, the most bitter betrayal came on May 28, 1830. Under Jackson's advocacy, the Indian Removal Act was passed. Nations east of the Mississippi were to give up their homelands forever and move to a special Indian territory in Oklahoma.
The American said, "The land shall be yours forever." Now they say, "The land you live on is not yours. Go beyond the Mississippi. There is game. There you may remain while the grass grows and the water runs. Brothers, will not our great father come there also?" Speckled Snake Creek.
At New Echota, Cherokee leaders felt deeply betrayed. Principal Chief John Ross and wealthy Cherokee landholder Major Ridge both had fought alongside President Jackson in a war against traditional factions of the Creek Nation. Meeting in violation of Georgia state law, the Cherokee Council vehemently opposed removal and reminded the nation of their law that carried the death penalty for anyone who sold Cherokee lands without authorization.
Even if report was favorable as to the fertility of the soil in Indian territory, if the running streams were as transparent as crystal and the silver fish abounded, we should still adhere to the purpose of spending the remnant of our lives on the soil that gave us birth. Cherokee Council.
Indian protests fell on deaf ears. The Choctaw were the first made to bend.
Painful in the extreme is the mandate of our expulsion. I ask you in the name of justice for a repose for myself and my injured people. Let us alone. We will not harm you. We want rest. We hope, in the name of justice, that another outrage may never be committed against us, and that we may, for the future, not be driven about as beasts who benefit from a change of pasture. We go forth sorrowful, knowing that wrong has been done. George Harkin, Choctaw.
Between 1831 and 1832, 13,000 Choctaw made the long and difficult trek to the west. 2,000 were to die along the way.
My voice is weak. You can scarcely hear me. It is not the shout of a warrior, but the wail of an infant. I have lost it in mourning over the misfortunes of my people. Their tears came in the raindrops, and their voices in the wailing winds. Our land was taken away. Colonel Webb, Choctaw.
The Creek were next. In the spring of 1836, the American Army forced them to surrender all their land. One third of the Creek died on the journey west.
The way I feel is there is a wound in our hearts. And that was a wound in our ancestors' heart. And that wound will never be healed. And that I feel like that whatever they do for us will never pay up.
Last night I saw the sun set for the last time. And its light shine upon the treetops, and the land, and the water, that I am never to look upon again. Minoa Creek.
Every year, from 1830 to 1838, Cherokee Principal Chief John Ross visited Washington, attempting to forestall removal.
We have been made to drink of the bitter cup of humiliation. Treated like dogs, our lives, our liberties, the sport of the white man. Our country and the graves of our fathers torn from us in cruel succession until we find ourselves fugitives, vagrants, and strangers in our own country. John Ross, Cherokee.
Ross wrote hundreds of letters. He met several times with President Jackson, with whom he had served in war. He petitioned Congress and brought two lawsuits before the U.S. Supreme Court.
We are not ignorant of our condition. We are not insensible to our sufferings. We feel them. We groan under their pressure, and anticipation crowds our breasts with sorrow yet to come. John Ross, Cherokee.
Ross did win one victory when the Supreme Court ruled that the Cherokee were a sovereign nation and not subject to Georgia's jurisdiction. But President Jackson disregarded the ruling and belittled the power of the Supreme Court by challenging the Chief Justice to enforce the law himself. Georgia held lotteries for Cherokee lands. State troops forced people from their houses. Cherokee government buildings at New Echota were sold off, along with the residence of Principal Chief John Ross. Cherokee leader Major Ridge also lost his plantation. He now became convinced of the futility and peril of resistance.
I know the Indians have an older title than the United States. We obtained the land from the living God above. They got their title from the British. Yet they are strong, and we are weak.
Major Ridge, as I understand it, he advocated for a good period of time that no more Cherokee lands would be sold or ceded to under penalty of death. And then later, he wound up doing the same darn thing, as a matter of fact, worse.
Ridge traveled to Washington without the authorization of the Cherokee Council. There, he met with federal officials. Ridge privately negotiated a treaty ceding Cherokee lands for $5 million, new land in the Oklahoma Indian Territory, and removal assistance.
We had been a country for 500 years before they were, and we were on an equal status. And every time we had a treaty from then on, we got a little less status and they got a little more land.
Ridge returned home to convince the National Council to accept the treaty terms.
I would willingly die to preserve the graves of our fathers, but any forcible effort to keep them will cost us our lands, our lives, and the lives of our children. There is but one path of safety, one road to future existence as a nation. That path is open before you. Make a treaty of cession. Give up these lands and go over beyond the great father of waters.
The National Council rejected the treaty. But Ridge, with no legal authority to represent the Cherokee Nation, met secretly with U.S. officials. Defying the council's death sentence for the selling of Cherokee lands, Ridge, his son, and others signed the removal treaty. On May 17, 1836, the U.S. Senate ratified the treaty by a single vote. The Cherokee Nation was given 2 years to move west. In that time, Ridge and 2,000 Cherokee emigrated to Oklahoma, while the vast majority of the nation ignored the illegal treaty and remained on their lands. In late spring of 1838, as the deadline for removal passed, General Winfield Scott arrived in Georgia with 7,000 soldiers. His orders were to remove the Cherokee by any means necessary.
Think of this, my Cherokee brethren. I am an old warrior and have been present at many a scene of slaughter. But spare me, I beseech you, the horror of witnessing the destruction of the Cherokees. Do not even wait for the close approach of the troops. General Winfield Scott.
Thousands of Cherokee were rounded up at Bayonet Point, unable to carry with them anything but the most necessary belongings, then held in stockades to await removal.
My great-great-grandmother, when they came to take them away, they drove them out of the house, didn't even let the kids get their shoes or anything. They were sitting down at dinner, and they got outside, and they were kind of roughing her around. And my great-great-grandfather kind of fought back. They throwed him in chains and took him off one way, took her and the children off another way.
Conditions inside stockades were terrible, and many died.
We have been made prisoners by your men, but we do not fight against you. We have never done you any harm. We are Indians. We have hearts that feel. We do not want to die. We are in trouble, sir. Our hearts are very heavy, very heavy. We cannot make talk. Cherokee Council.
16,000 Cherokee were removed from their homeland. Principal Chief John Ross left with his family on the last convoy. His wife, along with one quarter of the nation, would die on the forced exodus that would be known as the Trail of Tears.
The non-Indian people who came here did not view the Cherokee people as human beings, which made it easy to dishonor and desecrate these people.
People sometimes say I look like I never smile. Most of the time, I keep thinking of the old nation and wonder how the big mountain now looks in springtime, and how the boys and young men used to swim in the big river. And then there comes before me the picture of the march. Maybe someday we will understand why the Cherokees had to suffer.
While the body of the nation was forced west, several hundred Cherokee evaded Scott's men and retreated to the deep recesses of the Smoky Mountains. The army, ineffective at locating the free Cherokee, was recalled from the mountains. As the troops were withdrawing, one cavalry detachment stumbled upon a small camp of 12 free Cherokee. Among them was an older man, Sally, his wife, brother, and sons. When the Cherokee refused to submit to the soldiers, Sally's wife was jabbed with a bayonet and a struggle ensued. Two soldiers were killed. Sally and his family fled deeper into the Smoky Mountains. But U.S. soldiers had died, and now General Scott would have to make the Cherokee pay at any cost. With winter approaching, Scott delivered an ultimatum to Sally. Surrender, or 7,000 soldiers would be unleashed on the free Cherokee until the last of their nation was captured or killed. Sally made a fateful decision. He offered to surrender if Scott would let the rest of the Cherokee resistance remain in their Smoky Mountain homeland. Scott agreed, and Sally surrendered along with his family.
Charlie approaches and offers the gun, holding both ends with each hand. General Scott takes the gun, and they are to be martyred.
They were taken to a place at the mouth of the Tuckasegee River. There, Sally, his brother, and his two oldest sons would be executed by firing squad, tied to a tree, awaiting death. Sally had a last request of a friend.
Utsila, there's one favor I wish to ask at your hands. You know I have a little boy who is lost among the mountains. I want you to find that boy if he is not dead, and tell him the last words of his father were that he must never go beyond the Mississippi, but die in the land of his birth. It is sweet to die in one's native land and be buried by the margins of one's native stream.
On November 25th, 1838, Sally died for the freedom of the Eastern Cherokee people.
And when he died, he was a victor. He accomplished the thing which was uppermost in his mind, that his people might go free.
7 months later, in the new Oklahoma Indian Territory, Major Ridge, his son, and nephew, who had all signed the removal treaty, were assassinated for selling the Cherokee homelands.
Our next program moves west to the Great Plains and the famous horse culture that has come to define the First Nations of this continent throughout the world. Join us when 500 Nations returns with Struggle for the West. Welcome back to 500 Nations. I'm Kevin Costner. For a lot of us, the most vivid picture of the Indian world has come from movies. Screen heroes fighting armies of hostile Indians. The tide has changed in movie making, thankfully, but the image of Indian warriors riding across the Great Plains still remains the universal symbol of all American Indians. Yet even with this vivid image, we know little about the people and the legendary individuals who led them, men who fought and sacrificed everything for their nations. In this hour, we'll see the people of the plains in a different light. But first, we'll travel even farther west to a place where hundreds of thousands of Indian people lived in one of the most beautiful and peaceful regions of the continent, California. Welcome to Part 7 of 500 Nations, Struggle for the West.
...300,000 people lived in the diverse environments of California. They spoke 80 languages, worked, worshipped, and raised children on lands occupied by their ancestors since before the dawn of European civilization. Many California nations had evolved into highly structured societies. Among them, one of the largest was the Chumash, living on the coastal islands and along the coast in the area of present-day Santa Barbara. Large Chumash towns supported a professional class of astrologers, priests, government leaders, and healers. Workers belonged to centuries-old craft guilds of basket and canoe makers. Workers also manufactured the flat shell beads that were the currency of the region. Production and control of the money supply placed the Chumash Nation at the center of the Southern California economy. In the late 18th century, this complex world of the ancient Chumash and their coastal neighbors would be changed forever. In 1772, Spanish missionaries, led by Father Junipero Serra, arrived in Chumash territory.
Believe me, when I saw their general behavior, their pleasing ways and engaging manners, my heart was broken to think that they were still deprived of the light of the Holy Gospel. Father Junipero Serra, Spanish missionary.
Ignoring the beauty and complexity of Chumash society, the Spanish set out to convert them to Christianity by whatever means necessary.
I and two of my relatives went down to the beach to catch clams. We saw two men on horseback coming rapidly towards us. My relatives were afraid. They fled with all speed. It was too late. They overtook me and left food and dragged me for a long distance. Their horses running. When we arrived at the mission, they locked me in a room for a week. The father told me that he would make me a Christian. One day they threw water on my head and gave me salt to eat. And with this, the interpreter told me that now I was Christian, and that I was called Jesus.
The building up of the mission into a coercive labor force didn't happen overnight. It was a gradual thing, but eventually they began forcing Indians to remove from their free way of life in their home villages and to be reduced to one central mission site to be controlled. Once a family was taken in to the missions, the missionaries separated children from their parents. All the little boys and the little girls at age of six were locked up in children's barracks. So it was work, religion, and work all day long. Highly structured, highly supervised.
Indian people were put to work tanning, blacksmithing, and caring for the mission herds. They made candles, bricks, tiles, shoes, saddles, and soap. Labor was strictly enforced under the discipline of the lash.
And thus I existed, till I found a way to escape. But I was trapped. They caught me like a fox. They lashed me until I lost consciousness. For several days I could not raise myself from the floor where they had laid me. And I still have on my shoulders the marks of the lashes. Hanitil Kumiyai.
For over 50 years, the mission system, backed by Spanish arms, exerted control over the California coast, crushing every revolt. Inside the missions, disease and harsh living conditions contributed to a genocidal death rate.
The average life of a mission Indian was about less than 12 years. For children, it was less than 6 years. And so there was a constant need to feed this beast with laborers. One of the sad legacies of the missions of California is that when people go to them today, they don't even think about Indians. They say the Padres built the missions. That's nonsense. The California Indians built the missions.
At the Santa Barbara mission alone, over 4,000 Chumash names filled the burial registry, their bodies discarded in large pits near the church. In 1821, control of California transferred to Mexico after it gained its independence from Spain. The Mexican government secularized the missions. Indian people were free to leave. But 50 years had completely transformed their world. Old villages were gone. In their places were large Mexican estates. Even the mission lands they had worked and lived on became parts of vast private ranches.
To stand by and watch these men take over the missions which we have built, the herds we have tended, to be exposed incessantly together with our families to the worst possible treatment and even death itself, is a tragedy. Mission San Luis Rey, neophyte.
Homeless and left with few choices for survival, mission Indians were forced to exchange one master for another, becoming peasant workers on the rancherias.
Many of the rich men of the country had from 20 to 60 Indian servants whom they dressed and fed. Our friendly Indians tilled our soil, pastured our cattle, cut our lumber, built our houses, made tiles for our homes, ground our grain, slaughtered our cattle, dressed their hides for market. While the Indian women made excellent servants, took good care of our children, made every one of our meals. Salvador Vallejo, Mexican landowner.
In 1848, after the Mexican-American War, California passed from Mexican to American hands. Soon after, gold was discovered in the north, bringing a rush of miners onto the lands of interior nations who had been out of the reach of coastal missions and Mexican ranches.
The majority of tribes are kept in constant fear on account of the indiscriminate and inhuman massacre of their people. They have become alarmed by the increased flood of immigration much spread over their country. It is just incomprehensible to them. Adam Johnson, Indian agent.
Miners came into Indian communities looking for women. Vigilante parties opened fire on men, women, and children, wiping out entire villages. It was open season on Indian people, derisively referred to as diggers.
The Humboldt Times, Eureka, April 11. Headline, Good Haul of Diggers. One white man killed, 38 bucks killed, 40 squaws and children taken.
January 17th, headline, Good Haul of Diggers. Bend exterminated.
In the 1850s, while the American nation was on the verge of civil war over the issue of slavery, demand for agricultural labor in California was so high that the state legislature passed an act legalizing Indian slavery.
A company of United States troops, attended by a considerable volunteer force, has been pursuing the poor creatures from one retreat to another. The kidnappers follow at the heels of the soldiers to seize the children when their parents are murdered and sell them to the best advantage. W.P. Dole, Indian agent.
Only 30,000 native Californians survived the gold rush. 10% of what had been the most densely populated Indian area north of Mexico.
Upon my last visit to Ventura, I saw the last of the Ventura Indians. They were living in a tiny hut east of the mouth of the river. One of the old men told me they were very glad that I was not ashamed to talk the Indian language. They told me to continue in the use of it and keep the beliefs. If I did so, I would live a long time. Fernando Labrado, Chumash.
Fernando Labrado lived to be 111 years old.
I once went over to Dona Siana's house. I wanted to learn the swordfish dance. After the meal, I asked her to teach me the old dances, saying, "For you are the only ones left who know the old dances." Dona Siana began to cry, and I left saying nothing more. Fernando Labrado, Chumash.
For thousands of years, the buffalo thundered across the Great Plains, a vast sea of grassland rising from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains. Living off the herds were a scattering of nomadic Indian nations.
My grandmother told me that when she was young, the people themselves had to walk. In those times, they did not travel far nor often.
In 1680, the Spanish were driven out of the southwest by the Pueblo nations. As they fled, they left behind their horse herds, an animal that would change the way of life for Indian nations across the continent.
When they got horses, they could move more easily from place to place. Then they could kill more of the buffalo and other animals. And so they got more meat for food and gathered more skins for lodges and clothing. Iron Teeth, Cheyenne.
A new culture developed based on the relationship between man and horse.
My horse fights with me and he fasts with me. Because if he is to carry me into battle, he must know my heart and I must know his. But we shall never become brothers. I've been told that the white man, who's almost a god and yet a great fool, does not believe that the horse has a spirit. This cannot be true. I have many times seen my horse's soul in his eyes. 20 Coup, Crow.
With the coming of the horse, the nations of the plains would become legendary. The Crow, Cheyenne, Sioux, Blackfeet, Arapaho, Pawnee, Kiowa, Comanche. And for generations, their way of life
flourished. Then in 1858, gold was discovered at Pikes Peak, Colorado. 4 years later, the Homestead Act opened the region to white settlement. Almost instantly, the invasion became a flood. In 1 year alone, 100,000 emigrants swarmed across the plains over two main roads, spreading a wide swath of destruction. To protect travel on the emigrant roads, the United States erected a network of forts across the plains and churned out cadets at West Point, specially trained for Indian warfare. It was the Army's mission to force mobile nations who hunted over large territories onto confined areas, reservations. Indian people were faced with only two options: to give up their homelands and way of life, or fight the American army. Although some chose armed resistance, many Indian leaders, responsible for the protection of large villages of women, children, and elderly, saw little hope in fighting. Among these were two Cheyenne leaders, Black Kettle and White Antelope. They were willing to give up lands to maintain peace and bring their people safely through the dangerous era.
White Antelope and Black Kettle had a duty to their people to try to protect them. And to do this, they had to maintain peace. So they felt that it was their duty to go out and make peace with the United States. So they did.
Black Kettle and White Antelope ceded vast Cheyenne lands to the United States in 1861. And agreed to confine themselves to a reservation in exchange for protection from soldiers and settlers and assistance of food and money to replace lost hunting lands. They then traveled to Washington to meet with President Lincoln. Lincoln presented Black Kettle with a large American flag and White Antelope with a Medal of Peace. But over the next 3 years, continued unrest on the plains fanned rumors of an impending Indian war. In Denver, Governor John Evans inflamed public opinion by fabricating stories of Cheyenne hostilities and encouraged civilians to take up arms against them. Seeking protection for their peaceful bands, Black Kettle and White Antelope undertook the dangerous trip to Denver to meet with Governor Evans.
All we ask is that we may have peace with the whites. I want you to give all the chiefs of the soldiers here to understand that we are for peace and that we have made peace, that we may not be mistaken by them for enemies. Black Kettle, Southern Cheyenne.
Black Kettle and White Antelope were promised safety for their people if they camped near Fort Lyon in southern Colorado. But the military commander of Colorado, Colonel John Shivington, had no plans for peace with any Indian people.
Damn any man who sympathizes with Indians. I have come to kill Indians and believe it is right and honorable to use any means under God's heaven to kill them. Colonel John Shivington.
Black Kettle and White Antelope had been told where to camp and that they had nothing to fear from the U.S. Army.
Why would they worry? They were under the protection of the American flag. They were under the protection of the international peace sign, the white flag.
At dawn on November 29th, 1864, Shivington's Colorado volunteers rode through the snow toward Black Kettle and White Antelope's sleeping camp at Sand Creek.
Two women were out picking up wood when they seen what they thought was buffalo, but it wasn't buffalo, and they threw down their sticks and started screaming and running towards the camp.
Cheyenne George Bent was startled awake.
I heard shouts and the noise of people running about the camp. I jumped up and ran out of my lodge. From down the creek, a large body of troops was advancing at a rapid trot. I looked toward the chief's lodge and saw Black Kettle had a large American flag tied to the end of a long lodge pole and was standing in front of his lodge holding the pole.
Chief Black Kettle, he was out there in front protecting his people to show them that he wasn't afraid. And he was trying to tell them that, you know, we made peace, we're at peace.
Then the troops opened fire from two sides of the camps. The women and children were screaming and wailing. The men running to their lodges for their arms and shouting advice and directions to one another. White Antelope saw the soldiers shooting the people, and he did not wish to live any longer.
My great-great-grandfather, White Antelope, he felt heartbreak that another treaty had been broken. A peace that they had been seeking for so long time, for a long time, had been shattered, had been broken.
White Antelope stood in front of his lodge with his arms folded across his breast, singing the death song.
And he cried. He sung his song. Nothing lives long. Raised his arms. Nothing lives long but the earth and the mountains.
White Antelope, wearing the peace medal given him by President Lincoln, was shot dead in front of his lodge. Black Kettle and his wife ran toward the creek bed where people were desperately digging into the sand for protection. Before they could reach it, Black Kettle's wife was shot. Believing her dead, he ran on without her.
Most of us who were hiding in the pits had been wounded before we could reach the shelter. And there we lay all that bitter cold day, from early in the morning until almost dark, with the soldiers all around us, keeping up a heavy fire most of the time. They finally withdrew about 5 o'clock. As they retired down the creek, they killed all the wounded they could find. That night will never be forgotten as long as any of us who went through it are alive. Many who had lost wives, husbands, and children, or friends, went back down the creek and crept over the battleground among the naked, mutilated bodies of the dead. Few were found alive, for the soldiers had done their work thoroughly. George Bent, Southern Cheyenne.
Over 500 Southern Cheyenne people died. Black Kettle found his wife with 9 bullet wounds in her body. But miraculously, she was alive. The survivors straggled into another Cheyenne camp, while Shivington returned to Denver with over 100 Cheyenne scalps.
My people were massacred. Terrible thing. Their spirits are still there at the massacre site. Still, they're never rest.
Despite his loss, Black Kettle saw no hope in resistance. In 1868, his beleaguered band was camped along the Washita River on a government reservation. At dawn, on November 27, 1868, almost 4 years to the day after the Sand Creek Massacre, U.S. Army troops, under the command of George Armstrong Custer, attacked the sleeping village. Black Kettle, his wife, and over 100 of his people were killed. The Cheyenne leaders' quest for peace had come to a final bitter end, costing him his lands his freedom, and the lives of the people he had tried so desperately to protect.
I was born upon the prairie, where the wind blew free and there was nothing to break the light of the sun. The white man has the country which we love. We only wish to wander on the prairie until we die. Ten Bears.
South of the Cheyenne, the Goigu, or Kiowa Nation, lived on lands including parts of present-day Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas. They were also being pushed under reservations by treaties and the United States Army. But the message of Black Kettle's betrayal resounded across the plains.
The good Indian, he that listens to the white man, gets nothing. The independent Indian is the only one that is rewarded. Sit Daide, Kiowa.
To many, the only path open was armed resistance. A growing number of Kiowa rallied behind an uncompromising leader, Sit Daide.
A long time ago, this land belonged to our fathers. But when I go down to the rivers, I see camps of soldiers on its banks. These soldiers cut down my timber, kill my buffalo. And when I see that, my heart feels like bursting. Sit Daide, Kiowa.
Sit Daide was a deepening thorn in the War Department's side. In 1871, after leading a raid on a mule train in Texas, he was brought before General Sherman. Sit Daide defiantly accepted responsibility for the raid.
I led about 100 men to Texas to teach them to fight. This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Sit Daide was placed under arrest, shackled, and held in the crawl space below a Fort Sill barracks for 12 days. Finally, he was taken to Texas for trial. There, he was imprisoned. It would be 2 years before the Kiowa Nation was able to barter his release by surrendering their guns and horses. When Sit Daide returned to the reservation where his people were confined, he found that the money, food, and supplies promised by the government as payment for their lands had not come through. And the lifeblood of the nation, the buffalo, were fast disappearing.
Everything the Kiowa...